Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Lou Zambello hails from the great state of Maine and runs a program called Mainly Fly Fishing. His expertise travels far beyond the borders of Maine, though. He's the author of several books, notably In Pursuit of Trophy Brook Trout and Fly Fisher's Guide to New England, the latter being part of the Wilderness Adventure Press Fly Fishing Guidebooks. As in the other titles in this series, this has been an absolute reference material for fly fishing in the New England states. We dive deep into all things fly fishing in the Northeast, the changing water temperatures and the fishing patterns, Kerry Stevens flies, and tactics for success. Enjoy! Before we jump in, I want to let you know about the new travel section we have on the flyfishingjourneys.com website. Our goal and what we are passionate about is being on this fly fishing journey with you. That's why we go to the fly fishing shows and why we have started group travel with you. For the last 2 years, we have brought select friends and listeners to Iceland for curated hosted trips. We continue that with 2 weeks in Iceland this year, which are sold out, and 3 weeks in Iceland in 24, which are starting to fill up. These trips are pre-vetted for the best weeks on the best rivers. All the accommodations and details have been thought out and handled for our guests' convenience and enjoyment. This July, my good friend Tim Kamisa and I are headed to Alaska for some salmon fishing in the Bristol Bay area. I head back to Alaska in August to experience 2 additional lodges, new rivers, and different runs of salmon. July is more kings, chums, and sockeye, where August the target is silvers. Our goal here in Alaska is similar to Iceland, getting you the most hands-on current information. We don't have any Alaska trips to offer in 23, but stay tuned for more information for 24. The Fly Fishing Show Tour travels the country every winter. From January until March, the largest consumer fly fishing shows in the world will be in one of 6 locations. The regular stops are Marlboro, Mass., which covers the New England area, Edison, New Jersey, which is the New York, New Jersey, Mid-Atlantic States show, Atlanta, Georgia, Denver, Colorado, Pleasanton, California, the Bay Area show, and finally back to where it all started in Pennsylvania at the Lancaster show. These shows are super fun events that are packed with teaching, presentations, and everything you could ever want to know or see in fly fishing. Find all the details at flyfishingshow.com.
All right, thanks for being on the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast. Welcome. We're excited to have Lou Zambello, who's a native New Englander, native Mainer. He's an author, a previous guide, worked at L.L. Bean for many years. He actually wrote the Fly Fisher's Guide to Northern New England. Lou, thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
So we wanted to get into a little bit about this Fly Fisher's Guide, because, I mean, how many different rivers and streams and lakes did you cover in this guide right here?
You know, I've never actually counted. It's hundreds and hundreds. Maybe it's 1,000 if you include every little pond and every little section of stream, but a lot of water.
There's a ton of water here, and it's full color. It's packed with information on fly fishing all over New England. This actual book covers Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts. Any reason why you didn't cover Connecticut and Rhode Island in this book here?
So Wilderness Adventure Press has published fly fisher guides to every state in the United States. And there was already a Fly Fisher's Guide to Connecticut, which also covered some of Rhode Island. So I was covering the rest of New England.
Yep. Gosh, we're talking over 339 pages here. Lou, this is packed with information, full color, maps, all kinds of streams and lakes. I mean, it covers Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts. I mean, it's basically, you can consider it almost like the Bible of how, where to go fly fishing in these states.
That's what people tell me. There's a feature in there, actually, that I probably don't talk about enough, which is that just because people have a book on where to go, they often would say to me, okay, I have a weekend.
Yeah.
I have a weekend with my family. Where should I go? So at the end of each chapter for a given region, I recommend weekend trips, or if you have a whole week, here's where you go if you're by yourself, if you have a family, if you want other activities. So right. I actually lay out potential trips you could take.
Okay, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, what helps people that are trying to figure out where to go.
So Well, I want to talk about this Wilderness Press series here for a second, because yes. I've seen a bunch of these books, and they're so cool. How do you go about getting a book in one of these series?
So the publisher has been connected with the industry for years, and so he knows the people that are experts, and he sees them writing articles in magazines like American Fly Fishing and others, and so he approaches people. So that's how these become an author, and then these authors are with the publisher for decades, and
yeah.
So you keep writing revisions, and so that's how you get to get approached. Although I make the joke that it's so much work that, he said, when my publisher said to Lou, you're the best person for the job, I always joked that I was probably the 100th person he approached, but everybody else was smart enough not to tackle it. I was the one that was dumb enough to say yes.
There's nothing wrong with trying to go and write stories on all these great places. I mean, how many of these articles or sections or chapters are written specifically by you? Versus like maybe tying in a someone who fishes that locally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I felt that it was important that I personally was familiar with the area. You obviously, if it's a 25-mile river, you're not going to be familiar with every mile of
right.
the river. But I tried to go to every place in this book, and I would enlist local experts as well to give me a head start. So I would contact people that had written articles or the local Trout Unlimited chapters or friends that I had or guides that I'd run into, and they would take me out or help me. It was important, though, I did not do any sort of free guided trips, because that's how a lot of people write articles.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, take me out for free and then I'll write an article
right.
mention you. I felt like I didn't want to be beholden to anybody because they gave me a free trip. So to the degree sometimes I paid for guided trips, I paid for them.
Right.
So that combination, and then I knew a lot of places personally, and then I did a lot of traveling.
Yeah. What was your background before you started writing, Lou?
So, well, as you mentioned, I was a registered Maine guide. Before that, when I worked at L.L. Bean, I was involved in a lot of aspects of it, including the catalog, the production of the catalog, the creative. So I knew about copywriting, I knew about
yeah.
writing. I had done a fair amount of writing and other things. So it wasn't completely foreign for me.
Where is L.L. Bean? I mean, they were like the ultimate name in fly fishermen for years.
So they're in Freeport, Maine. And
I guess I misrepresented my question. Yeah, so they're in Maine, but where are they in the industry? Like,
sure.
I would come to these shows, they would be the biggest name here, and they were so tied in. I know they still do some stuff in fly fishing, but they're certainly not the name in fly fishermen they used to be.
No, they started with hunting and fishing, and then they just grew to this billion-dollar behemoth that was apparel and furniture, and they
yeah.
just became a much more general outdoor retailer,
yeah.
camping. And so fly fishing and hunting is a part of their business, and they still put out a catalog, and they still have a big fly fishing shop.
Yeah.
But they've expanded in other areas, and so they're not specifically focused in fly fishing anymore. So you don't see them around as much, but they're still around.
Okay, so you were working at L.L. Bean. Where did you grow up, Lou?
So I grew up in the North Shore above Boston, a place called Hamilton Wenham. And none of my family really fished, had no idea what it was about. And I had my first girlfriend. I was 6 years old. She had a little pond. She took me fishing with bologna as bait for sunfish. And I was hooked at an early age. And so in Hamilton Wenham, I would bike as a young age down to Shebaco Lake.
Okay.
And cast my worm off the dock, and I had been hooked with fishing ever since, and I was completely self-taught. Didn't really fly fish until I got to L.L. Bean.
Okay.
And people were like, oh, you got to try fly fishing. And I was like, okay. And so they took me to this remote L.L. Bean camp and took us out on this river. I said, I don't know what I'm doing. And there was a guy named Tom Sadar who was in the boat with me, and he's like, here's how you can cast 10 feet. You don't have to cast more than that. Just throw the thing over the side of the canoe. If a fish takes your fly, you know how to fish. Just bring them in. That's all there is to it. And so we got out on this stream in late June, and it was a cloudy, humid day. And I look out the side, and there are a bug coming off the bottom to the surface, breaking through and expanding its wings. I'm like, what is that? Tom Sadar goes, that's a green drake. And I look down this stream, and we happen to hit the beginning of this green drake hatch, and there were trout up and down the stream.
Wow.
From 4 inches to bigger, taking these flies, and my eyes just got big, and I caught a few fish, and I was so hooked on fly fishing after that. Of course, I never saw another green drake hatch for another decade.
How old were you at that time?
I was in my mid-20s.
Okay, that's about when I started.
And then from there, I just tried to learn everything I could and fish as often as I could until later on in life. Don't want to spend too much time on this, but my wife was a career-oriented woman, and we had an agreement. We got married that the first 20 years of our life, the primary goal would be my career, and then after 20 years, we would shift to her career.
Interesting.
So after 20 years in corporate America, we had three kids. It was time to switch, so I stepped out of corporate America, started working part-time as a consultant, then got my fly fishing guiding license and started guiding because there's a lot more flexibility, and she concentrated on her career with her health insurance.
Yeah.
And we did that for the next 20 years.
And how did it go? How did it all work out? Did it work out as planned? Are you happy with how it worked out?
I've never looked back. I thought it was great. I don't have a single regret, and my wife is now sort of a world-famous climate change scientist, so it worked out for her, too.
She's a climate change scientist. So how does that impact, like, what you've seen out in the fly fishing world?
So I'm obviously sensitive to climate change because I get an hour of it every night before my head hits the pillow. And I'm aware of the threats to a lot of fly fishing, particularly cold water fisheries, because of climate change. I mean, it's the largest threat we have in New England to our trout and salmon fishing. And when people sometimes get hung up over access or some relatively small issue, I always try to remind myself, if we don't solve the big issue, the little issues aren't going to matter.
Does she have ideas on how it can be solved? Because, I mean, I think that's the biggest, when I hear about climate change, when I hear about, you know, the ice melting, or when I hear about my friends here at up from Quebec, Canada, they're telling us that they can dip net for lobsters up in the St. Lawrence or up, you know, too far Canada that lobsters should be. It seems like the story's been written almost, like there's a hole in the ozone or whatever's causing the climate change is permanent. Is it reversible at this point?
That's a great question. And better to ask that question of my wife than me. But what I'll say based on what I've learned from her is because she studies the impact of climate change on the northern forest ecosystems. And she would say, yeah, climate change is going to happen, but there are ways we can mitigate it in terms of how it, you know, we got to let old growth forests grow. So that, because climate change means more drought and more big rain events. And so you need the ecosystem to be able to absorb water and release water. So clear cutting too close to streams, if we can let these trees grow bigger and let the forest revert to more of a natural state, it has the capacity itself to adjust to climate change. We have to be aware with dam releases to release enough water. There's a number of things we can do to mitigate the impact of what's surely coming.
Well, it doesn't seem to help what they're doing down there in the Amazon with all the clear cutting of the Amazon. I mean, that would seem to be, they call it the lungs of the world. And there's a lot of problems going on down there in the Amazon, both naturally with fires, as well as just clear cutting and logging in the Amazon rainforest.
I think we know now that we are not going to stop climate change.
Yeah.
We're going to try to do a number of things like move to electric vehicles and other things that are going to mitigate the increase.
Yeah.
But it's still going to, our average temperature is going to increase, and we're going to have more drought, and we're going to have more big rain events. And so we have to help the ecosystem be as natural as it can, because the ecosystem on its own can mitigate a lot of the effects of climate change. So that's what we have to do now as anglers or protectors of these watersheds, is to practice the right things so that we can mitigate the effect. Just not fishing when the water gets too hot.
Yeah.
Doing a better job of releasing fish so that more of them survive.
Yeah.
Keeping riparian corridors planted with trees and shade. There's a number of things we can do as anglers to mitigate the impact.
So she sees hope. There is hope to it. Because I think a lot of times when I hear about climate change, it almost seems hopeless.
Yes, I guess it depends on your point of view. Certainly, if you want to have lobster, if you're a lobsterman in Long Island Sound, the lobsters are not going to be there anymore. That's pretty hopeless. They're shifting north.
Yeah.
If you're a lobsterman in the Canadian border, it's great for you. So there's certain things that we will lose.
Yeah.
But there will be other things that we can
benefit from.
So it's just a matter of being smart and getting everybody to work together to do what we can do.
Before we jump back into the podcast, here's a short word from one of our fantastic sponsors. Are you a guide, a lodge, or a product manufacturer in the fly fishing or outdoor industry? I want to introduce you to and highlight Cross Current Insurance. Their entire team are great people and experts in their field. They have a guide insurance program that is amazing and very affordable. If you are a lodge or retailer, they also have programs tailored to your needs. These guys fish and are in the outdoors, so they know the industry and the landscape. To get more information on a program that's perfect for you, find them at crosscurrentinsurance.com.
So I actually had used your book recently, Lou, when I started to prepare for my talk for the Deerfield River that I was doing for a local Long Island Trout Unlimited. I fished the Deerfield River for many years growing up. I went out and took a bunch of pictures just specifically for my presentation. And I kind of used your book as a reference on the Deerfield River because of the 1,000 places that you talk about here in this book, the Deerfield River is obviously one of them, since that's one of the major tailwaters, one of the major fisheries in Massachusetts. Quickly, as I reviewed it, I'm going to get the elephant out of the room early here because quickly I could see that you have some of the known, I guess if you fish the Deerfield River, these would be the known spots. You know, we're talking about the Fife Brook Dam. We're talking about the Mohawk Park Campground, two very famous, very spectacular areas to fish on the Deerfield River that are kind of known. But you put the GPS coordinates. As a matter of fact, you put the GPS coordinates to almost every of the 1,000 spots that you talk about, the rivers and the lakes and the ponds, for many of the spots. And my question to you is, do you ever get any pushback for spot burning with your GPS coordinates in your book?
Of course. People get very emotional about their favorite spots. Yeah. I mean, I understand that. So do I. And so, sure, there are people that open my book and see a GPS coordinate to one of their favorite spots, and they're emotional about it. But the reality is, we live in a world where so much information is available. And I think the GPS coordinates are a convenience, but everybody that wants to fish an area has access to all that information. Everybody has a phone now with a map.
Yeah.
And so is where their car is. So if I do the GPS coordinates to the Camp 10 Bridge on the McGalloway, if they didn't have the GPS coordinates, they would just look at the map, see the Camp 10 Bridge, see their car, and they get there. Maybe they have to miss it the first time and turn around and come back. But to take the Deerfield River, there's how many guides guiding the Deerfield River?
Yeah.
And all those people are going down in that drift boat, and the guides are pointing out these spots. And then each person on their phone is dropping a pin. And then their buddy's calling them and saying, you know, hey, where's a good spot? Well, here, I'll send you the pin.
Yeah.
So all that information is out there. I wouldn't characterize my book like you did, where you said I gave GPS coordinates to most of the spots. I think I probably gave GPS coordinates to maybe 10% of the spots.
Oh, is that right? All right. Well, maybe I misunderstood.
Now, they're the most popular spots. But I actually wrote this book because I wanted to spread people out, because there's thousands of waters here. And I think people today have less time to fish, so they tend to gravitate towards sort of the known spots. But there's a lot of spots that the fish die of old age.
Yeah.
And so I actually think my book has served to spread people out.
So instead of going to that main river that everybody knows about, you're giving like 10 more rivers around it.
Yeah, I gave some GPS coordinates to the main part of the Deerfield, but I also talked about tributaries of the Deerfield.
Yeah.
But I also don't apologize for giving good information to anglers that are new, because to me the greatest threat to trout and salmon angling is not that there's a GPS coordinate to your favorite spot. It is climate change, which we've already just talked about, and development. And the only way to protect these rivers is if a lot of people love these rivers and then donate money or time or political influence to protect them. So I want more people, more young people, more women to fish in New England, because they are going to be the stewards of these rivers in the future.
Yeah.
And the only way they're going to fall in love with it is if they have success early on. So let me just give you an example, because I think this is an amazing example. There was a guy who worked hard, thought he might like fly fishing. I guided him. He bought my books. He had a great time. He fell in love with the sport. Last year, he donated millions of dollars to protect the entire watershed, or most of the watershed of the Kennebago River.
No kidding.
There is an investment in helping a new guy learn to fish and where to go that is now paid back in tens of thousands of acres being protected.
That's phenomenal.
So I don't apologize for making it easier for some new people to really get into the sport and be successful, even though sometimes it aggravates some of the older folks that have their favorite spots. I think it's a reasonable trade-off.
I agree. And I do love the analogy of you spreading people out, because with so much diversity in your books, it kind of gets you off of those main rivers that maybe other people are on, and you're kind of getting into some new water that maybe you would have never fished if not for finding it in a book like yours. So I think it's super quality. What made you get into writing?
I first started writing these books because I wrote notes to myself when I guided. At the end of every week or every trip, I'd write down, you know, here's a good spot.
Yeah.
Here's a technique that worked. Here's a pattern that worked. And I had these notes year after year after year building up. And as I got older, I started forgetting things. And you know that old expression, Lou Zambello has forgotten more about fly fishing than you'll ever know. It's like, well, I didn't want to forget it. So initially, I just wrote it down. I just wrote it down to kind of keep it in one place so I could.
Okay.
I wouldn't forget it. But I think as you get older, I just have an urge to give back. It's like I've accumulated all this information, and if I get hit by a car tomorrow, it's sort of all lost. Mm-hmm. That's, what a waste. I've spent miserable days learning bad lessons about, you know, what not to fish or where not to go. So I just felt the urge to communicate, and writing is a great way to communicate. Although now I try to communicate in Instagram and YouTube and other medium now,
right,
than books. In fact, books are declining while the other media are increasing.
Sure. So you said you grew up in Hamilton, Wedham. Did you fish Pleasant Pond at all? Or
I did not.
Okay. You went over to the Chebacco Lake mostly.
Well, I'm giving you sort of the short version, but I also moved when I was a little older to Avon, Connecticut.
Okay.
And I lived near the Farmington River. And I fished for crappie and sunfish at a place called Blyer's Pond, which was a little gravel pit. So I never caught a trout in the Farmington River. Because I was a kid, what did I know? I was just fishing for panfish in a pond. It wasn't until really I got up to Maine and started smallmouth bass fishing and then went to L.O.B. and then I started fly fishing.
So if you're saying you moved up to Maine, you went to start work for L.O.B., and you must know Macaulay Lord.
Very well. He and I are good friends. We've known each other a long time.
And the other thing that made me think that you must know Macaulay Lord is the smallmouth bass fishing.
Sure, yes. He's a big fan. He loves to put his float tube in the Androscoggin and float down. And I learned to fly fish. I really learned on smallmouth bass.
From Macaulay. The Andro.
Just being living there, and Macaulay and other folks at L.O.B.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he and I share a passion for smallmouth bass. And I talk a lot about smallmouth bass in that book.
Yeah.
A lot of places that I talk about.
I've gone out smallmouth bass fishing. I've actually gone out smallmouth bass fishing on our float tubes. We actually use, I think he might have used a float tube. I used a little Watermaster.
Sure.
And we went down, I might have been the Androscoggin. It was in Maine.
I know where you went. I'm pretty sure he puts in the Androscoggin right below Lewiston Auburn, and he drifts down to sort of Brunswick.
I just remember this massive rock at one spot on the left, and it was just...
Might have been further. And now there's pike in there, too, so you never know what you're going to catch.
Well, he's a great guy. Why don't you tell people a little bit about Macaulay Lord?
So he is a guy that's had a passion for teaching fly casting since he was a young man, and he's also a pastor. So he, you know, spends his time helping people. He's just one of those personalities that loves to help people. And maybe it's emotionally, or maybe it's spiritually, or maybe it's getting rid of their bad habits in casting. But, you know, he's been at it a long time. And he is recognized probably as the premier casting instructor in the country. There are other people that seem to crave publicity more, but I don't think there's anybody better than he is.
And he's a phenomenal guy, as you had mentioned. Well, that's cool. Macaulay Lord is a great guy. If you were to fish in Massachusetts, and I'm probably going to ask you to spot burn here again, why don't I pick the spot here? Because you talk about the Swift River. That would be a good spot to talk about, because you got the Y Pool. You park at the bridge. Are we talking about the same stretch of water? Okay, good. That you're shaking your head, yes. So you park at the Y pool.
You mean I shouldn't shake my head during a podcast? Is that a bad idea to shake my head? No. Yes, you're on the right track. Okay. Is that better?
Yeah, you park at the bridge. You walk up towards the Y pool. It's not a long stretch. What is it, maybe 3/4 of a mile or a mile?
Not even, I don't think.
Half a mile?
Yeah.
And always has fish.
Yes.
You're never going to not see a fish there.
Most of the time, yep.
Getting out to take something is a different problem.
Yes.
What would you recommend if somebody wanted to catch a fish in the Swift? Because a lot of times you can go there, see a lot of fish, and get skunked at the same time.
So you ask a question, and I'm going to answer a slightly different one, but then I'll circle back and answer that
one.
I would encourage people that there's other parts of the Swift besides the Y pool.
Okay. I love that.
There's a smaller Swift River that goes into the Quabbin Reservoir.
Okay.
And that has some small fish in it, and they stock it, and there's holdovers, and you will never see a soul in its small stream fishing.
Is it in your book?
It is.
Nice.
Another example of spreading people out. Also, if you go down the Swift River from the Y pool and keep going, it changes character, and there's downed timber, and there's other things, and there's some big fish down there. It's much more difficult to fish, but there's some good fish down there. And at this time of year, it might be even a little late, there's a sucker spawn further down.
Okay.
And the big fish move down there. So you don't have to fish that same stretch. However, back to your original question.
Yeah, and just for the people who don't know where the Swift is, we're talking about central Massachusetts.
Yes. It comes out of Quabbin Reservoir.
It's our largest reservoir.
It's a bottom release dam, so it stays the right temperature for trout all year. So you can fish it in January, you can fish it in August, and there are fish there. And they put a lot of fish in, and the fish hold over. But it gets to be very technical because those fish see endless flies.
Mm-hmm.
And my suggestion to folks, after first saying that I'm by no means an expert because I don't fish there that often, is you have to show them things that they haven't seen, and you have to present them naturally. And there's a lot, all bottom release dam fisheries are sort of artificial because most streams don't have that kind of temperature thing.
Yeah.
So most tailwaters have a lot of tiny, tiny little bugs.
Yeah.
And so the people that are successful there fish size 22, 24, 26.
Yeah.
Tiny, tiny stuff. And so to be successful, often that's what you have to do. And you have to show them a color or a particular feature that's slightly different from what they've already seen. Because fish that get hooked eating something, don't eat it again. So, find tippets and patience and don't try to, can't cast over them, can't scare them. You have to, because fish, oftentimes it's not that they are being, that they see your fly and are saying, no, no, no. It's they've already seen you or the overhead cast or some motion or some ripple. So to give an example in another watershed, the Rapid River in Maine gets a lot of fishing pressure. And these big trout will hang out by these rocky piles from leftover when there's a dam there. And they'll be right there. The minute an angler with cleats walks on those rocks, makes a sound that travels through the water, and those big fish are
gone. Yeah.
So you got to think of yourself as a heron on that stretch of the Swift and be very quiet and try not to spook them and then fish very small. Or sometimes just fish big stuff that they haven't seen before. Again, if they haven't seen it, trout don't have hands. They can't. They got to bite it to see what it is.
Well, that's what I hear is the 22 is a big fly over on the Swift.
But I've also had people do pretty well fishing big honk and stuff, too, that the fish haven't seen.
Interesting. Midges.
That's the small stuff are usually midges.
Yeah, the small midges. Small black flies.
Or red or white or yellow. So, again, it depends.
Yeah. I like those tips. So, you fished a rapid?
Yeah, I guided on the rapid.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
You know Aldro French?
Yes, very well.
Character?
Yes.
He's a good friend of mine. I've fished up with him many times. And for those who don't know, Aldro French was the curator, the caretaker of the Forest Lodge and the Winter House, famous from Louise Dickinson Rich's book, We Took to the Woods.
He owned them.
Yeah, he owned it, yeah.
Not now, but he did.
Yeah, for many years. And I fished up there with him. He was a great guy, right there on the Rapid River. Why don't you tell our listeners a bit about the Rapid River in western Maine, I guess it would be?
So the great thing about western Maine is that it still has habitat that grows very large native brook trout. And the Rapid is part of that system. The McGalloway is part of that system. The Dead and Swift Diamond Rivers, Kennebago, the Rangeley River. These are all watersheds that have rivers with lots of food. They have lakes or ponds, and they have streams. And so these big fish can move all around. They can move where the food is. They can move to thermal refuges in the summer or refuges from the cold in the winter. They have spawning habitat. And these fish move all over the place. Like, they've done tracking studies where a big brook trout will go 20 miles in 3 days up and down that whole watershed. And the Rapid River is one part of that. So a fish in the Rapid River could be in Umbagog Lake the next day, then could be in the McGalloway, then could be up the Swift Diamond, and then all the way back. So it's a fascinating fishery. And it also has a lot of landlocked salmon in there as well. Now, unfortunately, smallmouth bass have found their way in there. But it's still a great fishery, with one of the few places in the United States where you can catch a native brook trout significantly over 3 pounds.
How much damage are the smallmouth doing? I know it was a problem back then. I'm sure it's a bigger problem today.
Yeah, I should be qualifying almost everything I'm saying here. It's my opinion. I'm not I'm not a scientist. I don't spend my life on one watershed. Certainly the smallmouth bass have had some impact. I think all of the landlocked salmon that they have stocked in there also have had an impact.
Okay.
I think the increased fishing pressure has had an impact. Certainly the warmer temperatures have had an impact, because there's less time of year where they're in that river and they're not down at the bottom in cold water at the end of the river. But despite all of that, people go there and they get a shot at a big brook trout. And maybe they used to have 3 or 4 shots, and now they only have 1 or 2. But people are happy with that. And you catch salmon all day. So it's a great river.
And so, Lou, talk a little bit about a name that maybe, well, some people don't know, is the originator of the Grey Ghost, and that's Carrie Stevens.
So Carrie Stevens was a female fly tyer during the heyday of the big trout in the Rangeley area. And I'm not sure I get the dates right, but somewhere in the late 1800s.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine how long the winters were back then. You know, no internet, no TV. What do you do all winter? You tie flies.
Yeah.
And she had a particular style of tying flies that imitated smelt, which were the major food source of big trout and salmon. And so she tied these flies, and she tied something called the Grey Ghost. That turns out, I have a photo in one of my videos that shows one of her original flies next to a smelt, and it's interesting how close it is.
That's
to
wild.
Imitate. And she, the rumor goes that she cast from Upper Dam her Grey Ghost and caught a 5-pound trout, and she was famous ever since. Now, what you have to know about Carrie Stevens is she was a great fly tyer. She was an even better marketer. Did she actually catch a 5-pound trout? I don't know. She tied a lot of different flies. She would find a well-heeled sport from Boston, New York, that had money. She would name it after him. And then he was so, with the ego, he would buy a whole bunch of flies to give to his buddies because this fly was named after him. So she tied a lot of different streamers, would change one little thing and then name it after some guy. And so they would buy a lot of them. So she was very clever.
So you're not talking about just one person. She did this more than once.
Oh, she did all the time. If you look at the names of her more obscure flies, these are all well-heeled anglers, or some of them anyway. So there was a lot of marketing going on.
That's amazing.
But the Grey Ghost has stood the test of time because people still use it today. Now, the forms they use today are much superior to what she did, because we have materials available now that she did not have.
Yeah.
But I still fish a Grey Ghost for big trout most of the time. I just use a marabou version.
We're going to take a short commercial break to hear from Tim O'Neill of Norvice. What makes the Norvice different than another system?
There are a lot of rotary fly tying vices out there. The Norvice is the only vice that will truly spin when you tie flies, and there's a big difference between rotating a vice slowly and spinning it at a bit of a faster RPM. And being able to spin the hook on a zero axis rotations opens up a lot of doors for us in the world of fly tying.
Tell me about the introduction of colors to the Norvice system.
When we obtained the company from Norm, he said to me just a very, very short statement. He said, you know, I always thought a colored Norvice would be a cool item. We brought out 5 colors: Radical Red, Sunset Orange, Shamrock Green, Liberty Blue, and Royal Purple. We have 5 colors along with the black that you're accustomed to seeing with Norvice, and we've been doing very well with those.
To find more information and their online store, visit nor-vice.com.
Where do you live now, Lou?
So, several years ago, I decided that I never wanted to wake up where I wasn't next to water. So in the colder months, I live on a place called Dundee Pond, which is an impoundment of the Penobscot River that comes out of Sebago Lake. That's in southern Maine. And in the summer, I live on Kennebago Lake north of Rangeley. So I'm on the water regardless of which house I'm in.
So in the summer, you live south of Sebago Lake.
In the summer, I live up in Kennebago in the mountains. And in the winter, I live south of Sebago Lake.
So in the summer, you're living up in Kennebago, up in Rangeley.
Yes.
And in the winter, you're down south of Sebago Lake.
Yes.
You said the Penobscot River. What is that one stretch? I believe it's fly fishing only river just coming out of Sebago Lake. Is that the Penobscot?
Yes, Route 35.
Some big fish in there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So every day of the year, pretty much, you will find somebody fishing the bridge on Route 35 because it's a good fishery and there's holdovers that move up and they stock it heavily. And during the more popular times of the year, there might be 15 cars there. And there might be guys fishing, women fishing every 100 feet. There's another 8 miles of the Penobscot that you will never see a soul, but the fishing can be very good. But again, people gravitate towards the known spots. And so I hardly ever fish Route 35 because I know of another 25 spots on the Penobscot that have pretty good fish where you might not see a soul. So it's just another example of people gravitating to the known stuff. Now, they go to 35 because most of the stocking takes place there. But they stock other parts of it, and there's holdovers. I have caught the biggest brown trout I've ever caught in the world was in New Zealand. The next biggest brown trout I've caught in the world is in the Penobscot River.
No kidding.
5 minutes from my house.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard there's big fish in there.
So it's an unsung fishery, but everybody fishes the same 300-yard stretch.
Now, what is protected there, that stretch you're talking about? Is it fly fishing only?
Yes.
Fly fishing only, catch and release?
You know, I'd have to look and see because I release everything. And the
people, sometimes we don't check
that. And the people I guide release everything.
Yeah,
so I'm sure you could keep fish there. I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I do know it's fly fishing only from the Sebago Dam all the way down to North Gorham Pond, which is about a mile downstream.
Okay.
Then after that, it's general law. But the fly fishing is still great. You know, just because something is general law doesn't somehow make it, you know, off limits or doesn't make the fly fishing very good.
Well, we've talked a bit about Maine. We've talked about Massachusetts. Now, how about one of the lesser known or lesser visited from out-of-staters fly fishing states, and that's Vermont.
Sure.
I've actually done a podcast in the Stowe area where we talk about the Lamoille and the Winooski.
Yes.
What are some other fly fishing, and that was with Bob Shannon of the Fly Rod Shop. What are some other maybe good, attractive spots to fly fishing in Vermont?
Sure. Sam better now. I say sure and yes as opposed to nodding.
You're doing good. This podcasting, though.
Vermont is such an interesting state. I always tell people, go fish Vermont because fly fishing doesn't have to be an endurance contest. You don't have to go to some beaver bog in Maine and get eaten alive by mosquitoes and eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for 3 days. You can go to Vermont, walk into a stream, get hungry and thirsty, walk out, walk 100 feet down the road to a microbrewery or a homemade bakery or, you know, so live a little. Go stay in an Airbnb in Vermont with your kids or whatever and fish. And so there's any number of rivers. You mentioned two of my favorite.
Okay.
But there's the White River, and then right below is the Black River. The Black River has a section that's a trophy section, and so they stock big rainbows and big browns.
What area of Vermont are we talking about here?
Central, eastern central.
Okay.
Vermont Route 130 parallels the river.
Yeah. Okay.
And there's a trophy section that's a mile or two long, and they stock it with really nice big fish, and they change the regulations so that you can't keep too many. And I was there one afternoon. I had not fished this trophy section before, and I looked at this big riffle, and then the water kind of combined together in this little run, and I sat there with my elk hair caddis, and I cast it at the beginning of this run. As it drifted down, a big brown trout came up and looked at the fly, then came down, didn't take it, changed flies, tried it again. He looked up, didn't take it, tried it, changed again. Third time was the charm, came up, ate that fly, buttery brown. He clearly had been stalked, but not this year, probably the year before.
Holdover.
I could have been in Montana.
Yeah.
Love the trophy section of the Black River.
That's amazing.
And there's a number of well, you mentioned two, and I mentioned it, but there's lots of small streams, too.
Yep.
I was traveling up to the Clyde River, which is northern Vermont.
Clyde. Yeah, it's supposed to be have a great salmon run in the fall.
Big salmon. I mean, if you catch a three-pound salmon, nobody even looks at it. It's like, eh. But six-pound salmon, that big.
What are you waiting for that to happen? There's like an influx of water or something that happens?
Well, that is dam-controlled, but just when the water temperature gets to a point, usually in October, is when they start moving out of that big lake. It starts with M, whose name I can't pronounce, Mumbagog or Mumbagog or something. But on my way up there from St. Johnsbury, I was exploring for this book. I took a wrong turn, ended up on this back road, going over a bridge, and the bridge was closed. It was out, and it passed over this small stream. And, of course, I'm doing research, and I'm an angler, so I've already stopped the car. Might as well look out. Ooh, might as well grab my fly rod. I'll just see what's going on.
Yeah.
Caught a nice little brownie, caught a nice little rainbow, caught another nice little brownie.
Wow.
A nice little stretch of stream in the middle of nowhere. Had never even heard of it. I'm not going to tell you the name, but it's in the book. But so there's a lot of little small streams in Vermont.
That's
and then
cool.
Further in southern Vermont, the Middlebury. You know, the brown trout move from big rivers to the smaller rivers in the fall. And that's just trout. I mean, Vermont won a great pike fishery.
That's what my buddy goes up to the Clyde River for, is the pike.
Clyde River?
Was it Clyde? No.
In southern Vermont, Otter Creek?
I thought it was a Clyde.
Maybe there's Otter. Clyde is dam controlled, and there's different sections. There might be pike in Clyde. But Otter Creek in the southern west part is known for its giant.
I mean, yeah.
Giant pike.
Well, that's cool. All right, so we got Vermont.
But, you know, I should say one other thing about Vermont, because I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture. Here's the downside of Vermont. It's farmed heavily. They farm right to the edges of some of these rivers. It's a flash. These rivers flash. If you get any sort of rain, they get muddy. Not all of them, but they get muddy. You have to really understand, almost need a spotter out in Vermont to say, what are the conditions? And they get warm in the summer.
Yeah.
Different sections get warm at different times. So it takes a little while to figure out when it's fishable. When it's fishable, these rivers, the Winooski, are great, but they're not always fishable. So you have to kind of learn to scope it out. That's the downside of Vermont.
Yeah, that's good information right there, Lou. I appreciate that. One last state that we're having covered that's in your book is New Hampshire. Now, in New Hampshire, you have just incredible water. You have the White Mountains, so if you want to go for small brook trout and up in these, you know, small little streams around the White Mountain State Forest.
Yes.
Then you have the Connecticut River flowing up from Pittsburgh and the first Connecticut Lake, second Connecticut Lake, third Connecticut Lake.
Yes.
And then what's the last one there? Below the third Connecticut Lake, there's a campground right there,
yes.
And you can catch some nice landlocked salmon up there.
Okay.
Where would you kind of point people for a New Hampshire experience?
Sure.
Because New Hampshire itself, I mean, it's an entire experience in itself.
So I'm going to talk about two areas. First of all, southeast New Hampshire has a very interesting program. There are four rivers there. There's the Exeter, the Lamprey.
I know. They call it the Three River Stocking Program that they have there. Yeah,
yes.
I'm familiar with your analogy that you're going down. I don't know the third river there, but
Lamprey,
Exeter,
Isinglass, Exeter, and we'll look up the fourth.
Yeah,
and yes, a private hatchery stocks those rivers in October. They changed the regulations so people put the fish back, and until April. Those fish are there, and they're beautifully grown fish. You wouldn't tell, you wouldn't know that they were put in there. And it's a great fishery all winter. So when people are like, well, I'm going crazy. I can't fish Maine. I've had wonderful fishing there in November, early December, a warm day in the 50s. You go to those rivers, you nymph or whatever. And, and it's a great way to extend the season. And it's within a drive of Boston, Portsmouth. So I love that part of New Hampshire in the winter. The other thing I'll point out is that everybody talks about the Connecticut River up high near
where we were talking about.
But a little bit further down, In the summer, when, again, everything is too hot, that's a bottom-release dam, so that water stays cool. So when there's nothing going on, so I live in near Rangeley, when in August, early August, there's not much going on, I drive with my kayak over to the Upper Connecticut, and I put in right across from where there's a rest area on the main turnpike there, not the M-A-I-N-E main turnpike, the main.
Yeah, the main.
New Hampshire turnpike.
Yeah.
In the evening, and I just paddle upstream. There's all sorts of places, upstream like 300 yards, and then I drift down, and there's always rainbows rising in the seam. There's earthen banks there. And I catch some nice rainbows on an August.
Right.
On just caddis flies, no fishing pressure, hardly see anybody, maybe a drift boat once in a while.
Yeah.
And so there's parts of the Connecticut, again, they get underfished. There's a bazillion people way up where everybody goes, but just down a few miles, you get fishing to yourself, and there's plenty of rainbows there. So there's two parts of New Hampshire that people don't necessarily think about.
Certain, you paint a perspective here that I love, being a native New Englander myself, Lou, that you don't always have to get in a plane to go do this fantastic fly fishing. Sometimes we think we need to go to all these major destinations, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Belize, Canada, Labrador. I mean, there's all kinds of great places to fish in the world.
Yes.
And I like to do it. I'm guilty as anybody to love to go do that.
Yes.
But being a New Englander, you know, we do have great fishing here. And you might just have to downsize. You're not going to catch necessarily a 22-inch every time you go out. But maybe you can enjoy catching a nice 16-inch rainbow because you're just kind of getting out. You're getting your book. You're using it as that destination Bible that we talked about. And you're making a weekend out of it with your wife. Maybe you're going to do a bed and breakfast, an Airbnb, or what is this new one there they call now? Furbo or...
Yes. What is
VRBO or something.
Yeah, Verbo.
And,
it's interesting you mention that because I just wrote an article. I write for the Maine Sportsman, which is a monthly magazine in Maine. And in the winter when it's, you know, everything's frozen, I will write a destination article column. And I wrote a destination column about New Zealand. But knowing that a lot of people don't have the wherewithal to get to New Zealand, the next time I wrote a column, I wrote, and here are places in New England where you can go and you would think you were in some of these places.
Right.
And the Westfield River in western Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. I cut my teeth on it.
Within sound of the traffic on the Mass Pike, there is the side of the road, there's a pull-in, and you walk to the river, and there are giant trees overlooking the river. They have vines. It looks very exotic.
Yeah.
The water's clear. It's going over cobblestones.
Yeah.
And there'll be rainbows sipping, dry flies on the far seam that are really difficult to fool because it's hard to get a good drift. And you would think you were in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't much difference between, other than the noise of the Mass Pike, but if you could block the noise out, you would think you were in New Zealand.
Well, like I say, I learned how to fly fish. Some of my early experiences in fly fishing were at Indian Hollow, where we would do our annual Trout Unlimited rendezvous right there on the Westfield River in Indian Hollow, a giant campground on Western Mass. So I can definitely appreciate the Westfield River and what you're talking about here. You have a couple other books. Before you wrote The Fly Fisher's Guide to New England, you wrote Fly Fishing Northern New England Seasons,
yes.
Lou. What was the general thoughts behind writing the Seasons book?
So when I was guiding, I really wanted people new to the sport to be successful. And a lot of them were not successful, and they got frustrated, and they left the sport. And I thought that was a shame. And one of the reasons they weren't successful is they fished the same way. They put the same flies on with the same techniques, whether it was ice out, summer, fall. And there's a lot of ecology and microbiology that goes on season to season that's different. You know, the trout and salmon are in certain places opening day. Then there are other places that ice out. They eat different things. Then there's a sucker spawn. Then there's early hatches, late hatches. Then there's summer. And then there's fall and winter. And each one of those seasons, the fish move to different locations. They eat different things. And so an angler, to be successful, really needs to understand what's happening in those five fishing seasons. And so I wrote that book to say, hey, there are different seasons. Use this book to understand what you're trying to do so you don't fish the same way every season. You'll be a lot more successful. And people have really liked that book. They say they trot it out every year at a certain season. Okay, I'm going to reread Ice Out, or I'm going to reread The Fall so that I remember what's going on. Because remember, those trout and salmon in a lot of watersheds are moving miles and miles. And so that was the impetus behind that first book. And then after that, people were like, okay, I understand a lot more what's going on. Now write me a book on where to go. And so that was my second one that we've been talking about.
Talk about ice elk, because that's kind of like a big, I don't know if it's worldwide, but I know in New England, especially in Maine, the concept of ice out is very important to know about, especially if you're landlocked salmon fishing, and especially when it comes to the smelt.
Sure.
Tell us about ice out.
Well, I think there's two things about ice out. One is pretty well established. It's after ice out, smelt come from the deep parts of the lakes and ponds and move into shallow water to spawn, and the big fish follow them. And so it's all about catching fish that ordinarily are feeding on smelt 50 feet down. But in the early spring, when the smelt run for a week or two, they're feeding on smelt in 3 feet of water. And so, aha, fly casters have a much better shot. There's also something mysterious that goes on. Like right after the ice goes out, there's more oxygen in the water, and salmon and seem to bite, even though the water temperature is so cold you wouldn't think they would. And I think it's just something that all living things experience after a long, cold winter. It's like, yahoo, I'm still alive, and I have a nice spring of eating and then spawning to look forward to. It's like, I don't know, fraternity brothers going to Florida for spring break. I just think there's an element of mystery there that all living things after winter get a jump on their step.
So that, I love that.
But it's also the smelt running.
Yeah. Well, I love spring. I mean, my dad was always a fall guy. You go bike riding, we got to go up for the foliage, you know, we got to go leaf peeping and got to go for the Concord trails and always doing the fall things. And I enjoy fall, but for me, part of fall is, I mean, I know what's coming.
Yes.
Shoveling and snow plowing, snow. I don't love fall because it's so close to winter. I love spring. I love flowers. I love Easter. I love warm. I love looking forward to three seasons of joy rather than one season of misery.
The only thing I caution people that fish early in the season, smelt fishing, whether they're trolling or casting, is the water's really cold. Please be careful. You know, we find, unfortunately, guys every year that hypothermia and drowned, and they're found in the water with their fly open.
I've heard this story. Aldro French told me that story, yeah.
Because they stood up in the boat to take a pee, and they fell over and just couldn't get back. But should I talk about the third book?
Yeah, let's talk about it, because that's really my passion.
One.
Oh, this is the latest. Okay, because my passion is big brook trout. It's our logo, Fly Fishing Journeys. The brook trout, it's my favorite fish.
Yes.
I do have a passion for giant brook trout, and this is what this is, The Pursuit of Trophy Brook Trout. It's not a bad pursuit.
No, and people just ask. Well, I saw a statistic once that said that, I don't know if it's true or not, but it probably is, said 90% of the people that trout fish in Maine never catch one over 14 inches.
Wow.
And I'm like, that's terrible.
That's awful, yeah.
At least one over 14 inches. And the reason is big trout and big salmon are found in different locations, in different flows, in different habitats, and they eat different things. And so of course, there's always a story of, you know, six-year-old kid, first fly cast ever with a Hornberg, casts out there and catches a four-pound trout. I mean, that's what makes fishing fun.
Yeah.
But in general, to improve your odds, you really have to understand that big trout are different than small trout. You only get big because calories in have to exceed calories out.
I understand this concept.
Yes. And so they are trying not to burn calories and trying to get as many calories they can while not getting eaten by something. And that drives their behavior. And so it's a whole different mentality. I guess the best way to illustrate it is to tell you a quick story. I had a guy contact me, said, hey, I fish rangely. I catch some nice trout, you know, 12, 16 inches. I've never caught a trophy. What can you do for me? I said, well, read my book and then email me. And he goes, so I read your book. You're telling me that if I'm fishing somewhere and there's a hatch or I'm fishing the sucker spawn, rather than nymphing with my usual stuff and catch 12 to 16 inch trout, I should look for slower, deeper water and fish some giant streamer. Because you're telling me that big trout are actually eating the smaller trout that are eating the nymphs or the sucker eggs. I said, yes. And I didn't hear from him for a year or two. And then I got an email from him with a picture of this honking giant 20-something inch brook trout. And he said, I did what you said. I was fishing the McGalway. The suckers were there. People were catching some nice fish with sucker spawn. I put my nymphing rod down, and I picked up my streamer rod, like you said. I put sinking line on it, like you said, and I put some giant streamer on there, and I just dredged the bottom of the deepest hole for an hour. And I caught that big, big cannibal brook trout. And this is the fish of my life. Thank you very much.
That's awesome.
So that's just an illustrative story that, you know, you got to think about things differently.
The reason you wrote the book right there.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you don't write it to make money, I can tell you that. But you write it when you make somebody's
Somebody's day. Or life.
And he'll show that photo to every person he can show
great.
It to.
That's awesome. Now, does your book cover New England? Does it cover the Northeast? Is it worldwide? Like, if I'm in search of my trophy brook trout,
yes.
do I have to expand my horizon as far as destinations? Or?
So I talk about the world in that book, but it's really geared to New England and native brook trout. So out west, there's a place called Henry's Lake, which is near Henry's Fork. Everybody's heard of Henry's Fork. Well, not pretty close to there is Henry's Lake. And Henry's Lake has some sort of little protozoa in there that the trout feed on. And that lake is known for producing just gigantic trout because they grow like 6 inches a year.
Yeah.
Giant cutthroat, brown trout, and brook trout.
Yeah.
So if you want to catch a really big brook trout, along with go to Henry's Lake and mm-hmm. fish long enough and fish the right stuff at the inlets, and you'll catch one. So I talk about some of the other places, but most of it is for New England. I mean, Labrador, Canada,
Quebec. Yeah,
I mean, there's lots of lodges there. Go if you want to, you know, your best shot at catching a trophy brook trout, go to one of those lodges.
Yeah,
I caught my biggest brook trout at Minipi.
Yeah,
and the first afternoon, scouting to see what was going on.
Sure,
saw a fish rise. I thought it was a redfish. I'm like, that is the biggest thing I've ever seen. I said, look at the distance between the head and the tail. And the guy next to me goes, no, that was the head and the dorsal fin. And so my first cast with, in case anybody cares, a Quigley Green Drake Cripple on 5X, took it 8.25 pounds.
Yeah.
I had a Canadian guide. He was a Laker guide. So to him, 8 pounds, big deal. So
yeah.
Nobody's doing anything. I'm like, this is like the biggest fish I've ever seen.
So tell me about Minipi. I mean, are you mostly in ponds and lakes there, or can you fish rivers for big trout too?
So Minipi, they have different lodges. But
okay.
Minipi, it's lake fishing, but there's a river there. The lake drains into kind of a canyon.
Connecting rivers, almost, I call them, between the lakes.
Well, there's that. That's sort of more of a connector, but there's also a real river that comes out of that lake down into a canyon.
Okay.
And there are, quote, you know, I'm putting quotes in the air. You can't see over podcast, yeah. but smaller trout in the river, 2 to 3 pounds.
Okay, yeah.
And the bigger trout in the lakes.
Okay.
The smaller trout stay in the rivers because they're not big enough to avoid the pike
yep.
that are in the lake. So you get some river fishing there. We spent a fair amount of time river fishing. I haven't been there in a long time. It cycles back and forth, but it's been pretty good.
Yep.
And there's other places. There's plenty of places in Canada.
Yeah.
That's where the native brook trout, you know, still hold
on. Compare the brook trout in the Northeast and even Canada to Patagonia brook trout.
I will do that. I may not do it justice because when I go to Patagonia to fish, as you might imagine, the last thing I want to catch in Patagonia is brook trout. Thank you.
You
very
want to
much.
Catch a big brown trout?
Yes.
I understand,
yes.
but they do have beautiful brook trout
yes,
down there.
Yes, they do.
Ask Yvonne Chouinard. You
yes.
know, they've caught beautiful
yes.
brook trout down there.
It's not as easy as you might think.
Okay.
The same seasonality holds. Those brook trout are much more accessible during spawning season, where they move into certain inlets and outlets near the big lakes. And I've pretty much told you everything I know. So there are elements. The elements in my book, not that I'm trying to sell that book for Patagonia, but a lot of the same things hold true. A brook trout is a brook trout.
Are those, I guess my question is how they got there.
Well, we stocked them.
We did.
Yes.
They were like Northeast brook trout, or where did they come from?
If there's a really wonderful brook trout book that's, you know, 4 inches thick, blocking on the guy who wrote it. But he writes about where all the brook trout came from in every part of the world.
Are we talking Mark Kurlaski, or who,
no.
who wrote that book?
It's a shorter name. Anyway, we'll have to look it up.
Yeah, we'll
afterwards.
Look it up.
And he says where all these trout came from. But, you know, basically the people that moved down there wanted their trout fishing, and they grabbed brook trout, rainbow trout, brown trout from wherever they could get them.
Okay.
So they must have grabbed them from some, you know.
Wealthy people who wanted to fish down in Patagonia for these species.
They weren't necessarily wealthy. They were down there, you know, setting up sheep farms and whatever, and they just had used to fishing in Scotland. And in Chile, when Chile wanted to settle their country and produce a bigger economy. They thought sheep would work well in southern Chile. They went to Scotland, and they're like, which of the sheep farmers want to come down to Chile? And what are you farming now? 50 acres. We'll come down. We'll give you 5,000. Mm-hmm. And they were used to their lock brown trout, and so first thing they want to do when they get down there is somehow figure out a way to get brown trout eggs down there. So that's why there's brown trout in southern Chile. The descendants of the Scottish farmers that are still farming that land now.
Interesting. Well, great, Lou. It's been a blast having you on the podcast. I know we've tried to do this for a couple of years.
Yes.
But we finally got it done. Thank you. If people wanted to find out more about you, do you have a website? How can they buy your books and that type of stuff?
Sure. Well, my website is mainly flyfishing.com, spelled like the state of Maine, so M-A-I-N-E-L-Y, one word, mainly flyfishing. And I have my blog there. You can find out what's going on with me and with the fishing, kind of do it monthly, what's going on. And then my books are there, and if you want them signed by me, and you can buy them right off my website.
Very cool.
Or they're on Amazon, or they're in most of the fly shops around.
Yep.
And the other way, if you want to kind of find out what's going on with me in real time, is Instagram. I've kind of gotten to be a big Instagram guy.
Yeah, you're kinda huge.
Because it's kind of, I don't have followers like, Cardassians, but it's kind of fun to catch a fish or take a nice photo and be able to post it and be done with it. So
mainly
so,
fly fishing?
Yep, as well, yep.
So mainlyflyfishing.com and then on Instagram, mainly fly fishing.
Yes, and if you go to YouTube and put my name in Lou Zambello, there's some videos there as well on some of the places I was talking about. So I got my toe in social media.
Well, you're kind of the champion for the DIYer. I love that, Lou, because a lot of people, they want to go to a lodge, or they feel like they need to go to a lodge or find a guide all the time, and it's great to go out and get a guide. But if you're a DIYer, you want to go do it yourself, and you want good information to help you get there, we have the Fly Fisher's Guide to Northern New England. All 335 full-color pages of it, 1,000 destinations you can go choose
maps,
from.
Maps, everything, yes.
Maps and everything.
Yes.
So, Lou, it's been a blast to have you on.
My pleasure. Anytime.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.